Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. We have two very different guests today on the show. First is Bruce Blair, who previously worked at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C., an organization that provides expert analysis on various components of U.S. national security, international security, and defense policy. CDI promotes wide-ranging discussion and debate on security issues such as nuclear weapons, space security, missile defense, small arms, and military transformation. I conducted this interview with Bruce as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005. The issues Bruce and I discussed are still very relevant today. So from the Pacifica Radio Archives, please enjoy this discussion between myself, Helen Caldicott, and Bruce Blair. Bruce, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Helen.
I'm really interested, Bruce, in your personal experience when you were working at the Minuteman Launch Control and for the Strategic Air Command from 1970 to 74. Would you mind sharing a little bit with us about how that felt, what you're in control of and in charge of, and what you actually did?
We were in charge of 10 underground missiles aimed at the Soviet Union and China in the 1970s. That would be a crew of two people, myself and a crewmate, also in his early 20s. There have since been women inducted into the service, but at the time in the 70s, there were two of us in our early 20s, and we had primary responsibility for responding to any orders that would direct the launch of these 10 missiles that were in silos a few miles away from our underground capsule. And we had the ability to fire as a backup capability up to 50 missiles in the field of fields in Montana where I served. And I don't know, it was a job. In your early 20s, you don't struggle a great deal with matters of conscience. At least I didn't. There are plenty of exceptions, but they're probably all screened out of the service by the time they would ever reach the position that I served in. You pretty much were not people who were struggling with moral issues or anything like that. So we pulled alerts underground for several days at a time, several 4 or 5 times a month, and life revolved around watching little green lights, basically, and processing exercise messages and preparing for the possibility that we would get the big one.
Did you ever have any close calls in that time?
Well, to tell you the truth, we sort of always felt that we were leaning pretty far forward in the foxhole, as they say. That is to say, you know, we felt like we were kind of on the brink at all times, because our missiles were armed with very high-yield weapons, huge weapons.
What size were they?
This was Minuteman II, mm-hmm. which is an earlier generation, but they had yields of over 1 megaton, which means over 1 million tons of TNT. And so they were gigantic weapons. If we fired 50 of those weapons, the two of us single-handedly could have killed tens of millions of people on the other side of the planet in 30 minutes. We felt that we were on very, very high alert, very vigilant, and that, you know, our missiles, as I said, were armed with nuclear weapons in the nose cones and were fueled and ready to fire as soon as they received 3 short computer messages that we could have sent in a matter of literally seconds. And so the weapons were on hair trigger alert. If we received an order to fire them, we could have gotten them all out of the ground within less than 2 minutes. So there was a sense of vigilance And on occasion, though I was not on duty at the time, there would be false alarms that would be triggered by a malfunction in an early warning sensor, a satellite or ground radar, or some other event that would raise the level of anxiety and concern and bring you close to a sense of imminent war. And just to round out the thought, I had only really one occasion when I felt that way in real life, and that's in October of 73 during the Yom Kippur War, when the United States raised the level of its alert readiness as part of the confrontation with the Soviet Union at the time over the war in the Middle East. And I was on duty at the time that the message came down ordering us to go to a higher level of alert. And you felt like you may be headed somewhere because all of the training and preparation for this kind of moment conditions you to expect a particular sequence of events to unfold, beginning with something exactly like a message raising the level of alert, leading sort of inexorably to various increases in alert, culminating in the launch of the missiles. So psychologically, we were sort of Pavlovian dogs had a sense of anticipation when something like that happened.
So if it only took seconds to get the thing going and the alert, there was less than 2 minutes to do it, when they raised the level of alert, what exactly did that mean in terms of time frame and the orders to do it? What was changed when the level of alert increased?
Well, very little, because as I said, the weapons really by the 1970s were on maximum hair trigger alert and ready to go as soon as they received a few computer instructions, including targeting instructions. So we had very little to do. It's more of a psychological thing. We did go to our safe, the little lunchbox-sized red safe that contains the launch keys and the special codes used to validate the launch order. We opened up the safe and pulled out the keys and the codes. We put them on our consoles right next to us, and we strapped in and locked our chairs, which are, you know, chairs that are designed to, as the whole launch center is underground, to withstand a blast wave from an incoming Soviet nuclear bomb. Normally, you would walk around down there and conduct sort of daily business without any concern about being hit suddenly with a nuclear bomb. But when you go to this higher level of alert, then you're strapped into your chair and sort of semi-braced for the shock wave that might hit you at any time.
Oh, my God. What's the definition, then, of hair trigger alert? Because I'm going to lead now into what is happening currently. So what does it mean, hair trigger alert?
It means a couple of things. One is, as I said, the whole arsenal of American missiles, as well as Soviet and Russian missiles, are armed, they're fueled, they will fire instantly upon receipt of a couple of computer messages. Okay, so it's like the gun is cocked with ammunition in it, and it's just waiting for someone to pull the trigger. The other dimension of what I call hair trigger readiness has to do with the whole command and control system above the missiles, all the way up to the president. And in the 1970s, and later, the United States and Russia both adopted roughly the same posture of being prepared to react extraordinarily quickly to indications of an incoming strike by the other side, indications that would be reported by ground radar and early warning satellites. People don't realize it, but the procedures from the moment that an indication of attack arrives at an early warning center in either country until missiles could be leaving the ground, these procedures are extremely rapidly executed, and they involve thousands of people basically acting out a script, a prepared script. Mm. It's going to war by rote, by checklist. So that, for example, out in Colorado at Cheyenne Mountain, where all these sensors funnel in and are assessed, the crew out there is allowed 3 minutes from the time the first sensor report comes in until the time that they have to report whether North America is under attack or not.
And then they report that.
It's a drill.
Yeah. And that report then goes to the president, doesn't it?
Yeah, it goes all the way up the chain of command to all the commands. And so in that first assessment would be used to sort of cock us, for example, this crew out in Montana, to alert us to the possibility that we're under attack, that we should strap into our chairs and the like. And then the president and his top nuclear advisors are convened into an emergency session to consider a response. And as part of that, the president would receive briefings from not only the Early Warning Center, but also places like Omaha, Nebraska, which is the home of the Strategic Command, which has responsibility for all of our nuclear strategic arsenal. And the duty controller out there in the hot seat at the time of an apparent incoming attack then would brief the president on his response options and their consequences. And that person is allowed, guess how long?
How long?
To brief the president on these cosmic issues. 30 seconds is his timeline.
And how long does the president have to make the decision then?
The president has no more than 12 minutes to decide whether to retaliate and get our forces off the ground before the incoming strike would prevent the command system from working well any longer. And that's a maximum. That assumes that there are no enemy submarines off the coasts of the United States with short flight times. If that were the case, and it was during the Cold War, but it isn't today, although it could be in a crisis, then the submarine missiles might have flight times to Washington as short as 8-9 minutes, in which case then the president has between 0 and 3 minutes to make a decision. So it's an extraordinarily tight timeline. One of the best kept secrets of the Cold War has been that the United States and the Soviet Union both adopted launch on warning, launch on sensor indications as their primary strategy for response.
Are you surprised then, knowing intimately all these details, that in fact, we didn't blow ourselves off the face of the earth?
Well, I think that there definitely was an element of good fortune, of luck in that picture. It's hard to say. I think we were poised for a full-scale nuclear war with each other at the drop of a hat, and I think that we brought ourselves too close to the brink on too many occasions, and that with some bad luck, it could have been catastrophic. There were a couple of brilliant interventions by people who prevented this from happening, including low-level people who decided to ignore false warning, for example, and went against the rules in doing so.
Well, now let's get up to the present now, Bruce, when virtually nobody knows that there are still about 2,500 hydrogen bombs in Russia on air trigger alert, and the same here. And although there's been detargeting, I think you've said the retargeting can occur within 60 seconds. So though the animosity's gone between Russia and America, how does the present situation compare with what you just described, and what danger are we in now in terms of accidents happening and early warning systems making mistakes, computer errors and the like, taking into account what happened in January 1995 when the Russians made a very severe error and almost launched their arsenal? Can you tell us how things stand now?
Helen, the only difference between now and 10 or 20 or 30 years ago is that the number of weapons on hair trigger alert has declined somewhat, but there are still, as you point out, thousands of them ready to fly at a moment's notice. The only major difference, frankly, is that the Russian system of early warning has deteriorated, and so has its network of command and control in human terms and organizational and technical terms. It is an accident waiting to happen on the Russian side because of this economic stress on their system that has resulted in its degradation. So the basic postures are the same. We still have nuclear establishments that every day are preparing to fight a large-scale nuclear war with each other. They have not quite gotten the word from the political establishments that the Cold War ended. And technically, we're still locked in this very dangerous dynamic with the deterioration, particularly grave on the Russian side. There's one other important element, and that's the growing concern with nuclear terrorism, which to date has been concentrated on the danger that a loose nuke in a warehouse in Russia could get loose, could be stolen by a terrorist group and used, smuggled into an American city or someplace else and exploded and kill a lot of people. But there is also the concern that terrorists could interfere with the nuclear control systems
for
these huge arsenals on hair trigger alert, and raises serious questions about the wisdom of keeping these weapons ready to fire at a moment's notice, waiting for a couple of computer signals in an era of sophisticated computer hacking and other terrorist threats, sophisticated threats that could loom on the horizon.
God, I'd never thought of that. So we're talking about hackers possibly being able to induce nuclear winter. Because winter can be induced by 1,000 bombs dropping on 100 cities, and we've got 5,000 weapons on hair trigger alert, literally.
I appreciate the point about nuclear winter, but by the time nuclear winter would set in after thousands of nuclear explosions, I think it's, you know, there are a lot of problems there, that, including the immediate death and destruction of hundreds of millions of people. But at any rate, let me give you an example that is little known. Not very long ago, the Pentagon conducted a very tightly controlled secret study that found a electronic backdoor into the Naval Communications Network that is used to transmit launch orders to American Trident submarines. And the conclusion of this special group was very alarming, because they saw a way for unauthorized people, even terrorist hackers, to get inside the U.S. communications network and actually transmit a launch order to the submarine force. And it was considered serious enough of a problem that the procedures for validating a launch order were totally overhauled, so that the Trident crews would no longer respond to an unauthorized order the way they might have previously.
Okay, so I've got three other questions, Bruce. Is it true that a Trident submarine commander, with his permissive action links and working with his inferiors, could, if he became deluded enough, launch a nuclear strike against Russia with all the weapons in the Trident without communicating with the Pentagon? That's number one question.
There were two safeguards against the illicit firing of a Trident missile or missiles by the crew, or by a subset of the crew. One are elaborate procedures on board. And the second is a safe that holds a special key for the launch control system, that is a safe whose combination is unknown to anyone on board the submarine and must be received in the actual launch order in order to open the safe to retrieve the key.
Okay.
However, this is not a perfect safeguard by any means. It's more of a physical protection than it is a locking device, and it's easily imaginable that a crew could break into the safe and retrieve the key just using the equipment that they have on board.
So that's the first answer. Now, the second one is the deterioration of the early warning system in Russia, with, I know the satellites only work 8 hours a day now, only one third of the day, which makes the Russians very paranoid, for good reason, because isn't it still true that the United States military establishment in this area maintains a policy for a secret, preemptive, winnable nuclear war? Is that not so? And what does that do to the Russians?
The U.S. nuclear forces have options to launch a preemptive strike against Russia, against, in the plan, currently over 2,000 targets there, including over 100 leadership targets. And we position our Trident submarines forward We have at least four of them on launch-ready alert at all times, two in the Pacific and two at the Atlantic, mm-hmm. aimed at key targets in Russia. And if the order came to preemptively strike Russia, those submarines could fire their missiles and hit Russia within 12 to 15 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Flight time. So the Russians, even under the best of circumstances, with a perfect system of early warning detection, would still have really too little time to respond, although they are postured. You know, they are in a stance where they will try to make a decision and get their forces out of the ground before that incoming U.S. Mm-hmm. preemptive strike wipes out their command systems and their missiles.
Okay, so with this chilling description of what you just talked about, the clear and obvious question any sensible person would have is, how is it that the nuclear establishment in the Pentagon has been allowed to go on in an autonomous fashion, doing what they do without any oversight from the politicians or even letting the American people know that this horrendous situation, horrendous, still exists and that every second of every day our lives are at risk, millions, hundreds of millions of people, as you point out. How is it that they can still function like this with no oversight at all when the end of the Cold War took place in 1989?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that bothers me, and I have taken it upon myself, as you have to some extent as well, to provide that watchdog service and oversight, but it is not being provided responsibly within the U.S. government. It's an operation that is very quietly undertaken every day. Mm-hmm. You know, we fly these spy planes around Russia looking for holes in their air defense network through which bombers could fly to drop bombs on Russia in time of nuclear war. I was in Moscow in December. Mm-hmm. And talked to an active duty captain who complained about the fact that the United States continues to trail their ballistic missile submarines as soon as they leave port throughout their patrols. So it's a netherland, an underground, underwater, quiet operation that is not visible. So it doesn't come to hardly anyone's attention. And for one reason or another, there's just been very poor oversight. The Congress is not been granted very much access to the details of the war plan and of our operations. And there's very little political will to deal with this issue within the executive branch, the White House and the Pentagon. So it's a long-standing story. It's been the same throughout the Cold War all the way up to the present. And no one seems to be paying any attention.
So just the last question, how did you feel or how do you feel then with the Bush administration and its operatives in the White House now? And Bush really is the commander-in-chief in control of the button, A, and B, the background of what you just described with the Iraqi situation and other wars upcoming and the new nuclear posture review where they said they might or could use nuclear weapons where they so desire. How does that make you feel, knowing what you know?
Well, I feel that we are headed down the wrong path, and it's a misguided one that puts more emphasis on the use of nuclear weapons to deal with our security problems, lowers the nuclear threshold for deliberate use and for accidental unauthorized use. And I feel that we are moving in a more dangerous direction as we rationalize the use of nuclear weapons against a growing array of threats and contingencies around the world. The nuclear targeteers are having a field day these days to think of ways of using our weapons against more and more countries that are supposedly arming themselves with chemical and biological as well as nuclear forces. So I think we're just headed down a misguided path of increasing risk and danger.
I thank you enormously for what you've given us today. And if anyone would like to access your website with the information that you've just provided, how do they do that, Bruce?
Thanks, Helen. It is cdi.org, cdi.org. And I write a regular nuclear column now. And on the homepage of cdi.org, you can click on and read it. But we have a tremendous amount of nuclear-related data on our website.
That was Bruce Blair, who worked at the Center for Defense Information in Washington, D.C. at the time of the interview. The interview was recorded as part of a six-part series called The New Nuclear Danger for Pacifica Radio in 2005 and was produced by Scott Powell, Brian DeShazor, and Mark Torres in association with the Nuclear Policy Research Institute. Now I'd like to play a special interview for you, recorded on location in Madrid, Spain, where I attended a conference as a member of the International Science Advisory Committee to the Prime Minister of Spain, Zapatero, in July 2009. The conference gathered leading environmental and economic thinkers from around the world to advise the Spanish government on sustainable ecological practices. One of those leading thinkers is my next guest, Loretta Napoleoni. Today, I'm interviewing Loretta Napoleoni, who is a Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins University Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and a Rotary Scholar at the London School of Economics. As an economist, she worked for several banks and international organizations in Europe and the U.S., including the Club de Madrid. Ms. Napoleoni is also a journalist and has worked as a foreign correspondent for several Italian financial papers. She's written novels, guidebooks in Italian, and translated and edited books on terrorism. She was among the few people to interview the Red Brigades in Italy after three decades of silence. This research became the topic of her PhD. She's an expert on terrorism and the author of Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. Welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We've just been attending a conference that was organised by the President of Spain, Zapatero, and you particularly spoke today about the economic problems of the world and particularly those that are facing Spain. Would you like to give a little summary of what you talked about today?
Yes. Well, what I did, I presented the main problem that Spain is facing today, which is, of course, unemployment. Unemployment in Spain is rising very quickly, and it is rising faster than in other European countries. The reason why this is happening is because the two leading sectors of the economy, the one that have basically created the economic growth of Spain in the last 15 years, tourism and real estate, are the ones that are badly hit by the economic crisis. So the idea is to substitute growth, that, you know, of course, is not coming any longer from this sector, with another sector. Mm-hmm. So the discussion was very much about renewable resources. So I believe, as most of the members of the committee do believe, that this is a sector where Spain could lead the European countries. And this is because he has already done quite a lot. Plus, Zapatero is very sensitive to this issue, unlike other European leaders. So the idea would be to strengthen the renewable resources sector and also to absorb more and more employment into this sector, but also absorb some of the unemployed people. So use a system of reconversion, so to retrain people in order to work in this sector using the unemployment benefit, so that people don't sit at home idle doing nothing. Now, of course, this is a program that can be implemented right away, but, you know, in order to work, we need the medium to long term. You can't change completely the way the system works in terms of renewable energies overnight. However, Spain has already a target of, you know, achieving 43% of their energy consumption via renewable resources by 2012.
By 2012?
Yes, that's right.
43%?
So, yeah, in fact, actually...
That's amazing.
Because, you know, this is a country that can afford to do that because it's a large country. It's also a country that has a lot of sun and also very, very windy in certain regions. In fact, recently, a few months ago, there was a major storm, and during that storm, they achieved the 40%.
Did they?
Yes,
what,
they did.
From wind?
From wind, yes, from wind, from aeolian energy.
Isn't that
yes.
interesting?
Yeah, it is interesting, but it's also interesting that Portugal also is following the same path, mm-hmm. and together they are constructing one of the largest, actually I think it's the largest power energy from renewable resources power plant in Europe.
Is that the solar plant that they're
That's
building?
That's the solar plant that they're building,
Now
yes.
describe the solar plant for us so that we understand exactly how it works.
Well, this solar plant in particular, I mean, I'm not an expert, but you know, the way it works is that basically you use the solar energy in order to build up a certain kind of energy that then, you know, it's like, you know, using batteries to a certain extent.
So they're storing the energy.
Storing the energy.
Yes.
And then this energy can then be used. Mm. So why the storing is so important? Because, of course, you can't have an energy that is only based for when the sun is shining, because mm-hmm. of course, you know, if the sun is not shining, you can't, you know, shut down. So the idea is to use this kind of storage so that the storage can compensate when, you know, the plant is not working. And I think this is very much the future, because this is the way forward, especially for Southern Europe. Now, there is a lot of this kind of research done also in Greece. I mean, if you go to Greece, to the islands, it's extraordinary to see that every single house has a solar panel.
No.
Yes, yes.
Really?
Top.
Is that so?
Oh, yeah. They use it only to warm up the...
The water?
The water.
The
they
solar
don't
hot
use,
water
yes,
systems.
Yes, solar hot water system. Mm. But it is impressive that you go to these villages, which are, you know, in the middle of nowhere in the islands, and they all have that. You know,
isn't that
yes.
wonderful?
So I mean, Southern Europe should move towards that direction, because, you know, also the wind. Now, you know, the islands in Greece are extremely windy,
yes.
so you also find a lot of wind farms in these tiny little islands. So it is possible, it can be done. The problem is that you need to have a political willingness to do
yes,
it.
Yes.
And for sure, Spain, because of Zapatero, can lead the way for the other nation.
I'm interviewing Loretta Napoleoni, who was a Fulbright Scholar and is an economist, Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins University, and is also an economist and is also a specialist in terrorism. But let's just get back to renewable energy. Do you think if President Zapatero really decides to go for it, and he's talking about a third economy, a different, totally different economy than has ever existed before, do you think that he could employ hundreds of thousands of people and create, you know, swift railroads and solar systems on every house and windmills everywhere? Do you think that is a possibility?
Yeah, I think that's feasible.
Yeah.
I don't see why not.
No.
You know, Spain is a country that is very receptive to new technology. Partly is because this country has opened up to the world much later than the rest of the European countries.
Yes.
So they had a lot, and this is something actually Zapatero said today in his speech, they have a lot to catch up.
Yes.
But they have catch up very, very quickly. In fact, you see that, for example, the transportation system on you know, roads is much better developed than the one that we have in Italy. Italy, of course, built this transportation system, you know, decades before Spain.
Mm.
But Spain, you know, catched up. It was very good at using funds from the European community for areas that are less developed in order to do that. So the money could also come from the European Union, because there is a sector in the European Union that is specifically for this kind of activities. And if Zapatero really wants to do it, which I think he does, I think the country will be willing to do it. There will be less reluctance than in other countries. For example, Spain, for example, France will have a much bigger problem, because there is also that nuclear energy.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
I mean, the lobbies, the opposition will be so strong that it will be really hard for a government, not this one, of course, but for a government to make sure that things, you know, work the way...
Well, except if there's a meltdown in one of the reactors, 67 reactors in France, then that will be the end of everything,
well,
right?
Well, if there is a meltdown, you know, the entire Europe will be in trouble.
Well, Sweden got to within minutes of a major Chernobyl meltdown about 2 years ago. It didn't get much publicity, but it totally upset the Swedish people.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, nuclear energy is extremely risky. And there is no reason why we should have it, because, you know, we can have alternative energy. But the problem is that countries that have invested so much in nuclear energy, also countries that make money out of nuclear energy. Don't forget that 40 to 50% of Italian electricity comes from France nuclear plants.
Yeah, but the thing is that what is not taken into account with nuclear energy is the construction of the reactor, which is now enormously expensive.
It's very expensive.
It's up to $11 billion.
Uranium raising prices. Uranium is very expensive.
And it has to be mined and then enriched. And then you've got the nuclear waste that lasts for nearly 500,000 years.
Absolutely.
And what are you going to do with that?
Yeah.
So those costs are actually not included in the price of electricity coming from nuclear power. So the whole thing is sort of imaginary. It's a mirage, really, when they say they're making money.
It's one of the big illusions. But you know, this is the problem. The problem is that we live in a world of illusion.
We do.
We live, like, you know, inside the Matrix. You know, we don't know really what the world is, because, you know, we perceive the world through the media, through, you know, the politicians, and we really don't even have the instruments to question. I mean, how many people actually know, for example, that there is a link between, you know, cancer and other sicknesses in areas surrounding the nuclear plants in France?
Yes.
I mean, that's something that...
Has there been a lot of study done around the nuclear power plants in France?
There have been studies, but, you know, it's very difficult to get all of the studies. One of the people today was actually a French journalist who has done work on this topic, and he was telling me that it's impossible to get hold of that kind of research. Now, of course, you know, the government has it, but the government is very careful not to publicise that.
Yes, but they've done these studies in Germany around 16 reactors and found a really high incidence of leukaemia and cancer, particularly in children.
Yeah.
The closer they live to the reactor, the higher the incidence, and then the further away you get, the lower the incidence.
Yes.
So, there have been enough studies actually to have been done to know that...
Yeah, but they don't get publicised. I mean, you don't get... I mean, it should be on the front page of every single newspaper.
Yep.
You know, when you have something like this.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a major, major issue. But you know, you're lucky if you get page 25, you know, in a little box. This is not only because of the lobby. I think it's
what
also...
What is it?
Well, I think because government have not... They don't want to commit to an issue, which is the nuclear issue, which is a very delicate and political issue.
But why is it a delicate political issue?
Because for third world countries, the nuclear power is a sort of pride.
It's pride.
You know, it's pride.
It's also a testosterone factor.
Oh, absolutely. It's a male. This is very much, you know, a male kind of word. But you see, countries like Pakistan, for example. I mean, Pakistan, you know, gets, you know, the nuclear, that gets the bomb, basically. And that's
from its nuclear power plants.
You know, of course, in order to get the bomb, you got to have, you know, the nuclear plant, and you got to enrich uranium and all that stuff. So it's a long procedure. The bomb is the last thing. I mean, really, it's the tip of the iceberg, I think. But the issue is that once you have it, you automatically get in the club of the nuclear people.
Oh, sure.
So you are powerful.
You enter the portal of the nuclear club.
Absolutely. And you can negotiate with the big guys.
Yep.
Look at North Korea.
Yeah.
North Korea got so much money out of the simple fact that it was, you know, building a nuclear plant.
Mm.
And as long as this happens, I mean, as long as we go along and say yes, this is what we're going to do. We're going to give them money so that they stop doing it. And then they do it. And then eventually, you know, they test them. We give more money. And then we'll denuclearize and so on and so forth. Countries will have the incentive to build.
So are you saying that when North Korea got its reactors, it was given money not to build bombs?
Oh, absolutely.
By whom?
Absolutely.
I didn't know that.
By the U.S. Oh, yes.
The U.S. Yeah, how much money did they give them?
I'm going to send you my book. Yeah. I wrote a book about this, actually. Oh, no, not specifically on that. I wrote a book about the nuclear... Well, basically, the issue was to show that terrorism is not, nuclear terrorism is not such a big threat, because in reality, what these countries are doing is not building the bomb to bomb you, but building the bomb to negotiate, to get to that point whereby they can actually sit with the big guys. So the best example, of course, is North Korea.
Yeah.
So what North Korea did, started to do the proliferation, nuclear proliferation program, and then started to get money from the U.S. to stop doing it.
To stop doing it. Yes. How much money did they get from
billions,
the U.S.?
Billions. No. Through years
North
and years.
North Korea got billions.
I'll get you in touch with this guy who did the book with me. He's an expert on nuclear weapons.
I've had no idea.
Oh, yeah. He's at University of San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
He was at university with me at Johns Hopkins. So
yeah.
He actually is one of the leading experts. And he has all the documentation. I'll put him in touch, because it's extraordinary. It's completely extraordinary that, you know, they got money to stop the nuclear program.
And then they went on with the nuclear program.
Of course.
And then they built a bomb.
But there is no way you can, you know, this is the problem, is that, you know, there is no way you can actually make sure that once they have reached a certain level, these guys will stop. Because, you know, you may say, okay, you know, I'm stopping enriching uranium, but then, you know, you use the centrifuge and keep doing it.
Well, tell me then, Loretta, is anyone paying Iran?
No, anybody's paying Iran at the moment, because, of course, Iran refused to stop. So it's not doing what, of course, you know, the North Korean did, or what the Pakistani did, because, you know, in the end, the Pakistani got the bomb, right? Got the sanction. The Saudis paid for the sanction, $328 million.
Paid for what?
The sanction.
What See, sanction?
Because the United Nations, when it became clear that Pakistan had produced the bomb.
Yes.
The United Nations put sanction on Pakistan.
Right.
So the Saudis stepped in and paid a fine for the Pakistani to the United Nations. So they rescued them.
Why?
Well, because, you know, because of course they are allies, and, you know, this is the time. See, the bomb, Benazir Bhutto.
Because
is
they're
the
Muslims, is that?
No, because
right?
because Pakistan has very strong ties with Saudi Arabia because of the war in Afghanistan. So they were very close to each other at that time. And
but
still
why?
Today.
I don't understand the connection between the war
Saudis
in Afghanistan and the Saudis and Pakistan.
The war in Afghanistan was against the Soviets,
yes.
Right? So the Saudis bankrolled the Mujahideen.
Did they?
So, oh, yeah. The CIA bankrolled the Mujahideen. And then
the Taliban.
No, Taliban was the Pakistani, they actually bankrolled it. But, you know, the money's still the same.
Yeah.
So what's happened was that the CIA got the Saudis on board in order to fight
The Soviets.
So Osama bin Laden was the man that the Saudis used in Afghanistan in order to channel the money. But all the money went via Pakistan.
Yeah.
So it's called the Pakistani pipeline, it was called. A lot of that money, of course, was stolen, and a lot of money went to fund the nuclear plan. And Benazir Bhutto was, you know, the prime minister.
Yeah.
They actually backed 100% the nuclear plan. So when we discovered the nuclear plan, the bomb was ready, right? So at that point, the Saudis offered to pay, because the Pakistanis didn't have the money, offered to pay the fine to the United Nations.
Oh, my God.
See, I mean, if we have a system like that, that the country can actually buy its way out of producing a nuclear weapon. Now, of course, the Americans were very tough on the Pakistani until 9/11, so their relationship were almost broken.
Yeah.
But... of course, after 9/11, because of the story of the nuclear plant, the nuclear bomb. But then after 9/11, of course, you know, they started to be allies again. So they're back in bed.
So why did America become allies with Pakistan after 9/11?
Well, because, of course, they needed Pakistan as a sort of base in order to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan. Although, you know, they didn't in reality, because, you know, they used the B-52s, which, you know, can take off from
anywhere,
and then you get there. But the idea was to use Pakistan, and Musharraf was very willing to do that because he wanted to get back on the good books of the Americans. The Americans have sent $12 billion in the first 2 or 3 years to Pakistan. A lot of that money went back to, you know, the Taliban and to Al-Qaeda via the money they were given.
$12 billion, and it was much of it was for weapons, right?
Yeah, no, it was aid, because, you know, immediately, as soon as they become allied, they became eligible for aid. So they got a lot of aid, but the money went to the Pakistani government. The Pakistani government distributed their money within Pakistan. A big chunk went to Waziristan, which is the tribal belt where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban had took refuge.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that money helped the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to get back on their feet. You know?
How ironic.
Yeah.
How ironic.
But this is the world we live in.
The Americans paid for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda when they were supposed to be fighting them.
Well, you see how, and this is all linked to the nuclear power. If Pakistan had not had nuclear power,
right,
we would not be discussing this issue, because Pakistan would not have been a major player in that region. The reason why they wanted the weapon is because they had this plan, which again Benazir Bhutto was part of it, very much so, to become the new superpower in Central Asia. And in order to be the new superpower, you got to have the bomb.
Well, because India had the bomb already?
Well, this is true up to a certain point, because, you know, this is how they sold it to the UN. They said, you know, we got the bomb because India is our enemy and therefore we have to protect each other, which is ridiculous because, you know, two bombs, you know, end of everything.
Yeah.
But the true reason is that if you have the nuclear weapon, so if you have a nuclear plan, you are automatically catapulted into the leading. You see?
Yes.
So what we have to fight, to be honest, is this idea that having that bomb gives you an extra power.
But kind of it does, because if you have a bomb, America's probably not going to bomb you with conventional weapons, because you might blow up New York.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, Pakistan doesn't have, you know, bombs that are that range, I think. But
no,
still,
but I mean, it could be delivered in a suitcase.
Oh, yes. Well, no.
On a ship. Or on a plane.
Suitcases bomb.
Okay, a suitcase. Yeah. No, that's very sophisticated bomb making, but it could be delivered on a little plane.
Yeah, of course, it can be delivered on a little plane. So although you don't have, you know, the full range. But the issue is we have to produce a new paradigm for international policy.
Which would be
without the bomb. So a total denuclearization.
Yes.
And actually attaching to countries who have this plan a sort of stigma, a sort of negativity.
So how do we do that, Loretta?
Well, I think, you know, the only way to do it is to have, you know, a major, major, you know, foreign policy revolution, meaning the U.S. actually should be the country that, you know, would lead this, but I don't see this happening.
Even with Obama?
No, I don't see that at all. I mean, the denuclearization process, it's just not feasible. Because,
so,
you know,
what role should women play?
Well, I think
we're 53% of the world's population.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, actually women can play a big role, because you know, the truth is that women will get this kind of message. I mean, men tend not to understand, you know, the technicality of the. I mean, also the bomb is very male.
Very,
you know,
male.
It is very phallic. Also,
very.
You know, it's just so maybe starting to mobilize women on an issues like that, whereby you boycott countries with nuclear plans.
No, but that really means, you know, America too.
Well, of course, but, you know, I think we should say so. I don't think we should be afraid to say that America is also making mistakes. I mean, you know, to be honest, we are in this huge crisis because of America and because of the arm race. Because the truth is that, you know, the largest producer of small arms is still the U.S., and the largest consumers are still terrorist groups. So, I mean, you know, here is the link. I know it sounds Many people may say this is utopian, but perhaps what we need is an utopian approach.
Oh, we have to have a utopian approach, yeah. Otherwise we won't survive.
Yeah, that's what
I think. It really is survival.
Yeah, it is survival. I think we need the big return of utopia as a main philosophy if we want to save ourselves.
Well, I think you and I should work together,
yeah,
Loretta.
That would be nice.
I think we've run out of time.
I know. We should do something together. So what are you doing? You're going back now?
Back to Australia, back to Western Australia, where they're mining uranium like mad.
No.
So what we do when we sell uranium is we're selling nuclear weapons and we're selling cancer.
Yeah.
This is Dr. Helen Caldicott. I've just interviewed Loretta Napoleoni, who you can hear is an Italian. She was a Fulbright Scholar at Johns Hopkins University's Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C., and a Rotary Scholar at the London School of Economics. She's extremely well informed, not just about economics and the international economic situation, but also she's very well informed about terrorism and how it's related to the drug trade. And I think one day I'll interview her about that as well.
Now on the program, I'll read an excerpt from my new book, If You Love This Planet, published by W.W. Norton. I'm reading from the chapter called The Manufacture of Consent. In order to appreciate the influence and power that the transnational corporations exercise in the Third World, we must understand how they obtained this power in the first instance. Many of the global transnationals had their origins in the United States as small businesses over the last century. By a combination of competition, hard work, takeovers of smaller companies, and some ruthlessness, they became enormously wealthy and powerful. How did they manage to gain the support and cooperation of the American people as they achieved their power? The truth is that they have not only been competitive and somewhat ruthless in the Third World, but have also exhibited a history of exploitation and subtle coercion within their country of origin. Most Americans are not familiar with this history. Although this manufacture of consent, to use the phrase coined by the respected journalist Walter Lippmann, was investigated and soundly denounced by national church groups and congressional committees, the political and propaganda activities of U.S. corporations have continued unabated over the years and to this day remain largely unknown. The story of corporate propaganda explains, I believe, the strange and powerful patriotism and nationalism of the American people, their ready acceptance of propaganda and media manipulation, and the reality that US workers are not represented by a broad-based, powerful union movement. It also explains why the minimum wage in 1991 was only $4.75 an hour, and why there are insufficient occupational health and safety standards, no uniform free healthcare system, and no national system of free higher education. The minimum wage had increased in California in 2008 to $8 an hour and in New York in 2007 to $7.15 an hour, a paltry rise considering the cost of living increases since the early 1990s. Finally, the federal government raised the minimum wage on July 24, 2008 to the princely sum of $6.55 an hour, and 1 year later it is set to increase to $7.25 an hour. By comparison, the people of my native country are quite blasé about nationalism or patriotism. Australians rarely fly flags. But the minimum wage is $13.19 an hour, converted to US dollars, and the union movement is now relatively strong. Workers have excellent occupational health and safety standards, and we have a free healthcare system. University education was once free, but now must be paid for because the influence of the transnational philosophy and economic rationalism has infiltrated Australia and its politicians. Still, it's not nearly as expensive as a US college education. I rely on the following discussion on the work done by the late Alex Carey, an Australian psychologist who lived in the US during the 1970s and 80s. He was fascinated by the origins of American culture and made an extensive study of the history of propaganda and its political effects. From the beginning of the 20th century, large-scale professional propaganda campaigns have been waged by American business in order to shape public attitudes to accept and endorse the capitalist system, and this propaganda has changed the direction of American society. The campaign began in 1880 and 1920 in Britain and the US, when the right to vote was extended from 15% of the adult population to 50%. This popular franchise immediately posed a threat to the rich minority, because as real democracy was instituted, people would naturally be voting for laws that supported their own health, education, and welfare. For the first time, their tax dollars would be used to support the majority of the population and not just the rich. In 1909, two leading scholars, Abbot Lawrence Lowell, president of Harvard, and Graham Wallace, a leading British student of democracy, warned that the consequences of those new laws might be dangerous. They said, "Popular election may work fairly well as long as those questions are not raised which causes the holders of wealth and power to make full uses of their resources. If they do so, there is much skill to be bought, and the art of using skill for the production and promotion of emotion and opinion has so advanced that the whole condition of political contests will be changed for the future. In other words, if the power of the rich is challenged, they will use their money to intimidate and coerce people to buy votes and to produce a mandate for themselves." By 1913, a congressional committee had been established to investigate the activities of an organization called the National Association of Manufacturers, which represented many US businesses and had already begun disseminating vast quantities of literature with the apparent intention of controlling public opinion in the fledgling democracy. But public opinion moved away from that and did not support corporate philosophy during the First World War, which ended in 1918, because the American people were encouraged to work together for the good of the country. Women took equal jobs side by side with men, and a mood of unselfishness and generosity prevailed in the country. The techniques of propaganda were developed during the First World War, when the American people were reluctant to become involved. President Woodrow Wilson and others initiated a large and very effective campaign under the supervision of the Committee on Public Information, headed by George Creed, a Denver newsman, to convince the nation that Germany, whose people Creel called Huns, was the seat of all evil. Propaganda is the organized spreading of ideas, information or rumor, designed to promote or damage an institution, movement or person. World War I marked the first time in history that propaganda has been successfully conducted on a large scale. Within 6 months, the American people were devoted to hating the Germans and to defeating them in the war effort. Does this sound familiar? Replace Germany with Iraq, and we might as well be talking about the present day. Public opinion at that time had been so aroused that grotesque campaigns of witch hunting and Americanism abounded. Incidentally, in 1919, Samuel Install, who headed a vast utilities empire, took the entire hierarchy of the Information Committee set up by President Wilson during the war, and he used them to great advantage to protect private utilities against the threat of public regulation or ownership. Here lie the seeds of the public's remarkable support over the years for private utilities and for nuclear power. This is Helen Caldicott, and I've been reading from my new book, If You Love This Planet, specifically the chapter on the manufacture of consent. Thanks for listening to If You Love This Planet this week, and we look forward to meeting with you in a week's time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.